Welcome to Talking Beats with Daniel Lelchuk. We hope you'll subscribe and give us a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Now, if you like the show, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. We believe now more than ever in providing a platform for individuality, free thought, and a diverse range of views. By supporting the show this way, you'll get early access to episodes, bonus episodes, and much, much more. Remember, the conversation is always active at Talking Beats Podcast on social media. Here's Daniel Lelchuk.
On today's program, writer and professor Sherry Turkle is here. For decades, she's been chronicling the way we interact with computers, the way human emotions come into play as machines and computers play a larger and larger role in all of our lives. She's the author of the thought-provoking books Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, The Second Self, Computers and the Human Spirit, Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet, and Simulation and Its Discontents, as well as a book about the history of psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic politics, Jacques Lacan, and Freud's French Revolution. Sherry Turkle, who is the Abby Rockefeller Mosey Professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is out with a new book, The Empathy Diaries. The word empathy, as you'll hear, runs through our conversation, runs through her thinking. What is it? Why is this word so elusive to so many people who try to reach out, who try to understand? Sherry Turkle is here to explain. I'm thrilled she is. Welcome.
Delighted.
You've been looking at humans and emotions and machines for quite a few decades, and here we are in the pandemic, a year into the pandemic. It hopefully will be winding down soon, but the point is, a lot of what's been happening in the past year with Zoom, thank God we aren't on Zoom now, by the way, right?
Yes.
A lot of what's been happening ties in very intimately to what you have been doing for a few decades. What is happening now that you sort of saw happen over the long run since computers first came along, when you were early on at MIT, when Steve Jobs came over? Just give us some context.
Well, I think that one of the interesting things that happened is that everyone had a fantasy come true. You know, people would say, oh, you know, I'm so into my texting, I'm so into my screen, I'm so into my, you know, I love texting, not talking. This is the, you know, this is the way I can really be myself, because I don't have to, I can compose myself. I can find a truer self where I can compose my avatar. And, you know, talking face to face is so stressful, and this way I can sort of, you know, get more control. Well, now people, in a way, have have been able to immerse themselves, sate themselves in this medium that they've been, you know, and I've been this voice on the side saying, you know, be careful what you wish for, because certain kinds of capacities, certain kinds of human capacities are undermined if you just do that. And then here we are, we've all had this opportunity because we've had to be on screens all the time. And I think we wish for the full embrace of the human. I think we've missed, you know, we've had to do it, we've risen to the occasion, but I think we've missed, we've had a chance to value what we pined for, what we didn't know that we needed, which is that eye contact is so much, that sensing the body of the person you're with gives so much information. And when you lose it, you really lose a lot. And that the mere fact of being in the room with your students and your coworkers, you know, it's not just information. It's a sense of human connection and safety and trust, and that all of these things get eroded. And we're a little bit lost, I think, and very anxious as we go back to what the new normal, because we're not normal anymore. We've been sort of taken out of the mix in a way that we would never have anticipated. So I think that, you know, I don't want to oversimplify, but I think that this pandemic has really, I don't want to be Pollyanna, but it's made us a more mature consumer of the internet in ways that I tried to anticipate for people. And I certainly would never say I'm glad it happened, but I think that we come back chastened and not as optimistic and not as naive about what it is to live a life fully online. That's a long answer to a short question, but that is how I see it, that we'll be better consumers now of this very powerful medium.
You're talking about person-to-person interaction, and it doesn't have to just be in an extended setting. As an example, when all of this started, luckily we had a family property on a beautiful lake in New Hampshire, and I went there. It was completely isolated for a while, and I was thinking to myself, you know, at what point am I going to to forget how to interact with people in person? When is it going to happen? So I had been doing, you know, phone calls and FaceTime. Mm-hmm. This is before I was brought on board Zoom. I was an early Zoom resistor, so I was doing FaceTime and regular phone calls, which are wonderful, by the way. I think phone calls are far superior to a video call. And in any case, I said, okay, I'm going to go to the grocery store. So I went in and I said, am I going to remember how to talk to these people? So yeah. So by the time I left, I had the cashiers were laughing and I think they were smiling. The man slicing the prosciutto was, you know, was charmed. The whole thing was great. And I left with a big smile on my face thinking, okay, Dan, you still got it.
You've got it. You've got it. That's a wonderful story, because what I've been interviewing people now about is trying to take the measure of their true anxieties as they re-enter the quote world. And I think we have not yet taken the measure of how anxious people are and taken account of that as we talk about the new normal and about going back. Because in many ways, each of us has an area of vulnerability that being on our own and needing not to quote perform and needing not to sort of be social every day all the time, it's been a lightening of our load. But I think we're ashamed to admit that. I mean, you welcomed the chance to interact again, and people, of course, welcome the chance to be social again. But there's also this other side of it that I think we need to mourn what we've lost, but also to acknowledge that parts of us are nervous about admitting to ourselves and to others that our load has been lightened in some way by being able to hide from the world, that we were living lives of too much, just too much. Thoreau would say we live too thickly. I think this is going to be a difficult transition, because even having that thought is disruptive. It's not the official line. The official line is we can't wait to go back.
Don't you think there's some element of all this that someone would say, we have too much coming at us, we have too many Zoom events, we have too many lectures and concerts, and every violinist in the world playing the Paganini, every poet reciting Shakespeare, actor doing Shakespeare. I mean, there's an overabundance of options online, but I guess that sort of plays into what you were saying, that maybe we're a little more discerning.
Yes, and also you can turn it off. I mean, I let me be the first to step forward and admit I'll go to a reading, and I'll be one of those people in the Zoom audience who has my name up there, but, you know, doesn't have my, you know, doesn't, or I'll start out with my picture up there, and then I'll just have my name up there on the idea that I'm getting a cup of coffee or something. And then I'll just say, I don't want to hear this anymore. And on Zoom, I leave my name there. People are assuming that I didn't put on makeup, or I'm, you know, drinking coffee, or I'm sort of making dinner for my family in the background, and people aren't, you know, but really I'm reading a book and just don't want to be rude by, you know, signing out. But I, you know, that's what you can do online. That's why for years I've talked about how online life degrades our attention to each other in ways that are not good for empathy, because people never know if you're paying full attention to them. And that's, it's that feeling of full attention that is so nurturant of empathy, that is so helpful for trust and empathy, and that allows people to be vulnerable, which is where empathy is born. And if you really think that, oh, well, that box that says Sherry Turkle, you know, she may not be listening, and more than not listening, she may be writing her book, you know, that doesn't encourage trust, you know. You know, I think we've learned to modulate what we do online. And I worry about that in teaching. When my students turn off the, you know, turn off their faces and just become little blank squares with their names on it, I assume I've lost them. I assume I've lost them.
And you allow them to do that?
Well, you know, things have evolved in my classes. And when I first began, I thought my students were quite traumatized. My students were traumatized. Well, we came to MIT on a Tuesday. I had brought food, as is my practice. I feed my students. And I had brought the worst kind of food. I brought things like, you know, making nachos together. I mean, I just was completely out of it. I mean, I was like living on planet X. And I think my assistant said, Sherry, I think this may be the wrong kind of food. And I'd been like on a trip to California where everybody was, you know, eating Indian food, which was also the wrong kind of food. We were sharing food. And I went into class, I spread out this food. And I got a text on my phone that said, you're all leaving, you're all going home, pack up your books, you'll never see your, you know, we're closing down your office, take your last papers, if you need them, take your laptop home. And they had to leave sort of within 48 hours. They had to leave campus and go home. Trouble is, a lot of them didn't have homes. A lot of them didn't have stable families to home to, who had a room waiting for them. So they were then scrambling to figure out where to go. Should they rent an apartment for six in Cambridge and sleep three to a room? You know, I mean, they were really stuck. And they were traumatized students. I mean, for a college student, you know, where you, I've just written a memoir in those college years, you know, I reminded myself that, you know, those college years are a nest. They're a moment of being in a nest and just being thrown out on the street, you know, by, you're going to be doing your all your classes on the computer. And of course, I'm very careful with my students. I see them. I make sure they come to office hours. We'll get to that. That's another question. So, I mean, they were calling in to classes from closets because they were living six in an apartment and didn't have a space. So I was very gentle with them. I allowed them anything. I said, look, you know, I was very stressed. I was very afraid. I was terribly afraid. You know, one moment I was like the queen of Soul Cycle, and the next moment I was in an age group most likely to be intubated. You know, you know, it was like I crossed a line, you know, from being, you know, a young, vibrant me to having every, to seeing myself as some person who was, you know, a potentially ill person. It was very traumatizing. So I would say that in the beginning, I said to them, look, we're in extraordinary times. We have to feel our way very lightly through this and be very gentle with each other and very empathic with each other. You know, and for me, empathy means putting yourself not just in someone else's place, but really in their problem, really, and trying to walk that mile with them and trying to make a commitment to helping them in that problem. And that turned out to be, for me, the solutions I reached were a set of rules that were very different from when I began. I mean, to circle back to your question, that nobody could during the class. We had shorter classes, but nobody in the class could drop out. That this was our time together to be in a community, because I thought that that's what they needed, to be in a community. And I mean, of course, if somebody needed a drink or a cup of tea or the bathroom, and it wasn't like it wasn't Nazi time, but I mean, it was, the norm was that we were there to help support each other and be there for each other. And if you wanted to leave because something was wrong, you should tell us there's something wrong and can we help? And then secondly, everybody should come, you know, with tea or toast, or, you know, eating was allowed and people should be comfortable.
Coffee allowed?
Yeah, coffee. I mean, really, you know, to make it a time of gathering. And then I put in another rule that office hours were to be by phone, because people were very, that I would call them. We would have time alone, an hour alone on the telephone, because I found that people were literally, you know, doing classes from parks and playgrounds to get a Wi-Fi signal. They were in cars. People were living in very different kinds of situations. And it was stressful for them to be dealing with those situations and other people seeing those situations. And we talked about those situations. It took the emphasis off them to be having to have these complicated feelings about really where they had landed up. Because college masks all of that, you know, everybody's in a dorm. So social class and inequality, a college does everything to hide all of that. And a phone call, they knew that they had my full attention for that hour. And that was helpful. So I during Zoom, I sculpted, I shaped styles of interaction with students that I thought would help them most during the pandemic.
I've always liked audio only, meaning a telephone call, for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
We're on a phone call now, this sort of a glorified technology, but we're not looking at each other. And I don't sit here thinking to myself, I wish I could see you. Not that I'm sure you don't look wonderful and everything like that, but I don't feel I'm missing out by not having your face on the screen. And in fact, the opposite, I feel I'm able to go into a depth and into an emotional area that perhaps the image would distract from. Do you agree?
I do. And here's why. Is because in order, we are wired when we're on a phone call we are wired when we're face to face to get so much of our information and so much of our mutual mirroring that makes a face-to-face conversation work and makes us empathic, to be looking at the eyes of the other person and picking up the slightest flicker, the slightest, you know, change as part of our empathic connection. If we were on a Zoom call, in order to give you the illusion that you are looking in my eyes, that I'm looking in your eyes, both of us have to stare at that little red, at that little green dot on the top of our screen. In other words, both of us have to be looking at nothing, essentially seeing nothing during the entire call. So for me to feel, or just doing it from me to you, for you to feel that when I'm speaking, I'm looking in your eyes and giving you the signal of full attention, which is what people need to have that magic happen of feeling empathic connection. I essentially have to be looking at nothing and having no experience, authentic experience of empathy, because I'm just staring at this little green thing. And you, similarly, if you want to give me that full blast feeling, you have to be almost an avatar of yourself, you know, looking at. So whereas in a, you're shutting down the thing that makes it work. Whereas on a phone, we are wired to sort of almost close our eyes and listen for all of those signals, those subtle signals that come across in the voice. And we can. And it's a wonderful thing. And that's what gives you this sense of completeness. And I think that the decision to see my students during office hours was such a relief to them. And that feeling of being given to, you know, really attended to, which is what you want from an office hour. Office hours with your professor shouldn't just be, you know, I'll give you information, you give me information. No, it's a mentorship. A mentorship is, you know, you may not have it right, but I'll be there for you again, together again. That's what makes a mentorship. And in my new book, I talk about so many times when I didn't have it right, but when my mentor said, come back, you're good at this, come back and we'll get it right, until I got it right, and how wonderful that was. And you can do that on the telephone because you really are giving them full attention. It's full attention that our devices have taken away from us, and it's full attention that we have to demand for ourselves and our children when we go back to our new normal.
The lack of a visual stimulation is sort of how people like to go to a concert, go to a symphony, go hear me play Brahms sonata and sit there with their eyes closed. And
yes.
And there is something, I don't know if you're one of those people, we'll get to music because we always get to music here, but I don't know if you're one of those people who likes to listen to music with your eyes closed or sort of alternating. Some people like to alternate maybe 2 minutes with their eyes closed and they watch for 5 minutes or something. But it's a totally different experience. I would argue even the sound changes, not just your emotional response. It actually sounds different when your eyes are closed. Yesterday we were doing a test of a couple of modern violins with my colleague, Mr. Silberger, and comparing them with his Guadagnini, which is from the late 1750s, many million-dollar instrument. And so we were doing a blind test. And here I was sitting in the hall listening to him play a brand-new sort of $10,000 violin and then put up the old famous Italian millions of dollar violin. And it's amazing that when my eyes were closed, I literally heard things differently than when they were open.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful story. It really makes the point. But I cannot stress, you know, it's such a great story because it reinforces my own experience that even before the pandemic, my students would beg me to not have to come to office hours and to be able to just send me an email with the perfect question so I could send them the perfect answer. And I would, I finally just had to say, that is not where the relationship that's going to make our relationship important for your life is going to happen, with this fantasy of you're giving a perfect question and me giving a perfect answer. That's an engineering fantasy of how this is going to go. You're going to give me a really half-baked idea, because that's where the good ideas come from. And I'm going to say, that's a little promising but half-baked. Come again tomorrow. We can be together again together. And that is where our relationship is going to happen, and that's where these ideas are going to grow. In our society now, in our culture now, there is resistance to so many parts of the relationship I've just described. Number one, there's resistance. There's a fantasy that you don't need a relationship. You can put in a computer who'll just give you answers instead of a relationship. Number two, there's this fantasy that you just need the right answer. You don't need to go through all these steps. These steps are a waste of time. Why not just get to the right answer in this email in the first place? And then number three, there's this sense that all of that takes too much time, and that I'm kind of wasting their time, you know, with these repetitive again, together, together agains. But I'm trying to teach them how relationships work and empathy works, so I can grow them up to be a full, I see my teaching role is not just transmittal of knowledge packets. I'm trying to give to them what my mentors gave to me, which is a true love of learning and a way to think about what they're good at so they can be true lovers of learning. And in writing my memoir, there's been such a realization that really was what I was given in my education. Confidence that I could turn to myself and figure out, is this the right topic for me? Will this awaken in me the best in me? And you can't begin to answer that question if you've been going into every meeting with an advisor, you know, looking for a right answer. You're not being prepared. So I try to get them over to my way of thinking, which I think is a deeply humane approach.
Sherry Turkle, you've used the word a lot. The word is one of three words that make up the title of your new book. It's not a very long title. The title is The Empathy Diaries, and the word I'm talking about is empathy. What is empathy, and what do most people misunderstand about the word? I even got into an argument with a friend this morning about it when I said I was going to talk to you, and this friend mentioned something over text of, well, empathy is a performative act, and I was offended by it. I reacted strongly. I found it a simplistic, silly thing to say, to call it performative, and I said I have never felt that at all. What is empathy?
Well, you know, your friend, I'm sympathetic with your friend because I think everybody's talking about empathy now. Biden is the empathy president. We need empathy to get through, you know, to make friends with the Trumpers. Everybody is, you know, empathy is what American politics needs. I mean, everybody is high on empathy, but I mean something much harder than what most people are talking about. And it's the opposite of performative. I'm saying that empathy is the capacity to put yourself in someone else's place and then go beyond that, to put yourself through an act of active listening, where you begin not with, oh yeah, I kind of understand that. You know, I was divorced, I know what a divorce is like. Which is how most people, that's 5 minutes into most people trying to be empathic. They sort of, you know, identify and try to help. Mm-hmm. And my definition of empathy is you go in with a kind of radical humility. You know, I'm here to listen because I don't know how you feel. So tell me how you feel. I'm here as me to listen to you and hear not only you're at the place that you are at, but really to deeply understand your problem and to help you best I can, you know, with your life, not mine, but to stay humble about it, not offer you, you know, life lessons from my experience, but to, you know, really walk with you as you search for your answer, not take over your life, but to stay humble, but to, you know, walk with you as you sort this out. It's a commitment to you. And it's a very active enterprise. It's an enterprise with humility. And it's a committed enterprise. And the reason that I think a lot of people have trouble doing it or even thinking about that humility part is that in order to be empathic, you have to have the capacity for relationship, which begins in solitude. Empathy really begins in solitude, and the ability to draw yourself into yourself and know who you are. Because if you don't know who you are, when you turn to other people, you can't really listen to them because you're almost looking to them to tell you who you are. We hate those people. We shun them, but it's so common in our society to not take the time and not have the capacity for solitude and always be distracted by our phones. We don't really know who we are. And so when we turn to other people, it's kind of like we're trying to figure out who we are by letting them tell us who we are. It's like, I want to have a feeling. I think I'll send a text. And with this definition of empathy, which takes work, I really think that there's a lot less, people have a lot less interest in, you know, playing with their phones and a lot more to be gained by talking to each other and really engaging with each other. But you certainly can't get by with performance. And I think that's the big misunderstanding. And that's why so many people say, oh, I'll use a computer psychotherapist. I'll use a computer avatar to be a friend. It's because they don't understand that the performances that these artificial creatures can do is never going to get them to empathy. And it's sort of sad that so many people think that the best that they can get is a performance from people. Maybe that's why they're so willing to go to digital things, because they think that people are only going to get them performances. I think that's really very telling what your friend said.
It's telling, and it bothered me. And I said we're not going to come to a consensus, and I have to go anyway. We were texting. I actually have to go do this shortly, so I'm not going to text anymore about it. But it really struck me, and it offended me. As someone who's had, since the age of probably five, since right around when I started cello, a disarming quality, an arresting quality in conversation with people much older and in very different stages in life, that they open up to me in extreme ways. And I've had that, I don't know, ability or whatever, impact or influence ever since I was a little kid. And I think that is related to empathy in a way. It's a way that people are put at ease, that they suddenly want to share without even being asked.
Yes, but I think that the quality that made that happen, I can just say from chatting with you for a very short time, is that you give off the vibe that you know who you are, and so you're available to listen. And that's the quality that allows people or invites conversation, invites honest revelation, invites people to tell you who they are, because they don't feel that you're casting about for somebody to tell you that you who you are. And sometimes very small children have that quality, but when adults have that quality, but you know, leaving aside that there can be this kind of sense of containment with children, so this there being kind of people who people confide in, probably not the best thing, but they can have that from very young. Children can have that sense of containment from very young, and sometimes children who have a gift, or who are very introspective, people call them old souls. I mean, it's not good for them because they don't always have they have the aspect, but they don't have the life ability or emotional range to process what they hear. So it's never a good idea to use them that way. But it's the quality that makes that happen is the sense that you know who you are. So it's safe to talk to you, because you're not looking for other people to give you the clue to who you are. That's the dynamic. And that's why devices undermine empathy. That's the mechanism through which devices undermine empathy. It's not a question of just how much time we spend on them, or, you know, screen time should be this many hours or that many hours. It's not really about that. It's about when we don't give ourselves attention, when we have a moment for reverie and instead we go to our phones, we don't discipline ourselves to look within and say, who am I? Who am I when I have a moment of boredom? Who am I when I have a moment where I need to quietly just think about myself who am I? And bypassing that is really bypassing a step that will give you enough of a sense of identity so that you can be an empathic person who other people will trust.
I appreciate that explanation, that illumination so much, and as to what you just said about the moment of boredom, or what do we do in that moment? Everybody has been there, maybe even you, where you look at your phone,
yeah,
and there's, you know, there's not an email or a text you have to respond to right then, but you think, well, maybe I'll check the headlines. Maybe I'll read an article instead. If I'm not going to write a text right now, let me read that article in that other tab I had pulled up. You know, and suddenly,
or there's a movie,
and then suddenly, you know, an hour and a half later, you realize that you actually have been on the screen for another hour and a half. But let me just go back to something you said before, because you said one of my favorite terms. It's sort of a term, active listening, and it's a term that I use a lot in music when I give a master class, or even when people ask me how to talk to people. I say it's not just about listening, it's about active listening. And active listening, certainly in music, and I think conversation too, means you have to respond, you have to react. It's not just about, well, I heard the way you played that phrase in the Schubert sonata, and it was nice. It's no, I heard it, and I'm going to modulate what I'm doing immediately in the moment to fit with it. Otherwise, you've missed a chance. It has to be an instant reaction. That's what active listening requires. It requires you to react in the moment and to modulate. That's why so many interviews are so bad, because obviously the person asking the questions is looking at a list of questions. And it's so obvious when the conversation sort of is jumpy and it goes from one topic to another sort of awkwardly, because you feel the person not really listening. They're just looking down and going through a checklist, and it's awkward and jumpy.
Yeah, and the reason, and again, you know, I'm no Luddite. I mean, if you were here, you would laugh, because, you know, I have so many computers and phones and different kinds of earplugs and different kinds of headsets. And I mean, I really do look like I'm definitely not a Luddite.
What are we using right now, Sherry Turkle?
Right now, I have a phone. I have a phone because many of the people who I have interviewed me wanted me to do an external recording of the conversation. I have a very special computer that I bought up. I don't know if I want to give it a plug, but I bought it up because it was the last Apple that was small but was a full computer. Now they make them only 13 inches, and I have the last 11-inch full-size computers that they made at 11 inches. And I have a stack of them, and they, you know, one by one they they frizzle out because they're from 2011. But I'm only willing to use these. But I mean, I have a very large stack of technology. But the thing about active listening is that you can't do it if you lose the habit. And you lose the habit. I mean, it requires practice. Well, I want to just let me get to the chase. I mean, it's not something that just some people have it as a gift, but it's a gift that can get rusty, but everybody can develop it, but that takes wanting to, and it can have its awkward moments, because, you know, when you're in an engaged conversation of active listening, there's also somebody who's actively putting out, who's expecting something from you. And it's a high risk conversation. Because if you're actively listening and I'm increasingly opening up to you, I'm increasingly making myself more vulnerable. And as I raise the stakes of greater vulnerability, you have to be more and more attentive. So it's very important to stress this part of active listening, that it evokes more and more truth-telling on the part of the other guy. See what I'm saying? It's not like you just get more and more into a state of grace. I get more and more into a state of vulnerability, potentially. So that if you all of a sudden say, okay, that was great. I actually wasn't paying attention the last, you know, kind of like I sort of missed the last 15 minutes, but we'll pick this up again. I'm bereft. And if I'm a vulnerable person, I can be really bereft. So if I'm having office hours with students and I'm saying, I'm very careful to not be a psychotherapist when I'm a professor. You know, it's a very important line to maintain.
Because you can do both,
right?
I
can do both. But I mean, I know when I'm doing one and I know when I'm doing another. But if you say to a student, I'm going to be on the phone with you for an hour and it's your time. It's just your time. So let's talk. That student is going to talk. And that's a big responsibility on me, as opposed to if I just kind of march into it, you know, if I just kind of, you know, get them on Zoom and look at the other way and say, hey, so what's your best idea for the paper? And they come up with something pre-canned. I say, well, that sounds pretty good. You know, here's some reading stuff. Ciao. Nothing is at stake. Their emotion, you know, they've pre-wired it. I've had a chance to look at it in advance because they've sent it in advance. Nobody's going to be hurt and no one will be vulnerable. And I think that really it's that I always go back because I think that if we don't talk about what it's really about, we're not going to be talking about anything at all. What digital devices do is it gives us the fantasy that we can be human beings with less vulnerability. That's what talking to a computer psychotherapist is. That's what talking to a computer coach is. That's what having a computer companion is. You can somehow get through this life with less vulnerability. And that's the question of the pandemic is, some of us have come to realize that, you know, being hidden away in our hidden away each in our rooms with less vulnerability has not felt good. Has not felt good. And we've missed something that has to do with human vulnerability, which has to do with the essence of being human. And let's talk about that.
The essence of being human is encapsulated in great music. It's encapsulated in a symphony of Beethoven or an opera of Verdi or a serenade of Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra. Sherry Turkle, what role does music play in your life? I know for a lot of people, the past year has shown them they need music more than ever. I've been saying to a lot of people that music in the time of the pandemic has been sort of the one thing people can fall back on, a place of solidity, a place of reliability. You know it'll be there for you, and there's nothing artificial about it. What is music for you? Has it helped you?
It has helped me, but it's very interesting. I grew up in a home with no music, except the great American songbook of the classics of the American musical theater, really from 1918 to, you know, through the 50s and early 60s.
That's the best period.
And I grew up with it all. My aunt, my mother was divorced. We went back to a one bedroom apartment that we shared with my grandparents, my mother's parents, and her sister who wasn't married. And my mother slept on a fold-out couch with her sister, and I slept on a cot between my grandparents. And we had very little material possessions, but my aunt had, we had a record collection of the great cantors singing the classics, the great Jewish cantors. Jan Pierce, I'm thinking, was my grandfather's favorite, singing the classics of Jewish liturgy, literally as though they were rock stars. So Jan Pierce singing Kol Nidre was like, it took a long time for me to realize that this was sacred liturgical music, because this was like played like as one of the greatest hits.
Sure.
These were.
Well, he was an opera singer, Jan Peirce. So
he
brought
so, I mean, this
operatic
was,
quality to a
exactly,
sacred music.
Exactly. So we, I mean, I have to laugh that I thought when I actually found my way into synagogues where people were praying, you know, and I, you know, I used to spend, I loved my grandfather. My greatest pleasure was sitting on his lap and having my head in his chest as we listened together to Jan Peirce. I mean, these are my most precious childhood memories of being loved and of being part of this tradition, you know, going to temple and hearing, you know, mumbles. sort of. So, but everybody was singing Oklahoma and everybody was singing My Fair Lady and everybody was singing, you know, Annie, Get Your Gun. And so I found myself during the pandemic, first of all, having a sort of steady date with Yo-Yo Ma, who played what he called songs of solace from his kitchen, or it looked like he was playing it from his kitchen or his hallway.
That sort of corner there. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, there's some kind of corner in his house. Yeah. And I what I loved about it, so I did that and listened to and actually listened to chamber music. But I also went back and listened to the songs of my childhood. And I was writing my memoir at the time during the pandemic. So it sort of really helped me reimagine Brooklyn, because really I would come back from playing and either my mother would be playing the Blue Tango and dancing in the living room or you know, the Dorsey brothers. She imagined herself in a glamorous life dancing to the big bands, and those records were there. And she would be teaching me the tango and teaching me the foxtrot to get me ready for the life dancing to the big bands that she imagined for both herself and me. And then listening to the soundtracks of the music I grew up with. So between Yo-Yo Ma and chamber music and dancing around to the big band, I have had a very dancey and a very American musical stage pandemic. But it involved a lot of dancing. I cheered myself up by dancing and singing and putting on big musical numbers. And but also I was very moved, and I think a lot of people were, by this notion of these performances of music that were not performances, they were also solitary meditations. Because I've always felt that when you watch a great performer, you are watching something that is both performance and meditation. Now, that could be something the performer is, you know, giving you the illusion of, but that has been my experience of the performance of great music always. Because that really is what a writer is doing. I mean, a writer is creating in speaking, when I give a good speech. If it's a good speech, it's because I'm giving content that I've worked over and I know it and it's in the perfect order and it's very clean. But also I'm thinking while I'm doing it. It's not just packaged. You know, I know it so well that it also is me thinking. Like now, I'm actually thinking. I'm not reading something. I'm trying to make this connection. I hadn't thought about it before. The reason I think that the Yo-Yo Ma and also the Patrick Stewart reading Shakespeare was another non-musical example of a great artist reading the Shakespeare sonnets from his porch, was that when he came to a sonnet that he didn't like, he said, "I'm skipping this one. I don't like the way it treats women." And in a performance, he might not have done that. This was him thinking, I'm here as me, the person, too. I need to relate to my audience in a certain way. I'm going to throw off a certain kind of avatar of performance and share that I want to. This is for me. This is my healing, too. I don't want to read something that's going to upset me. During the pandemic, these performances engaged me in a way of thinking about my own creativity, where it, of course, was for my ultimate reader, but it really was for me, too. And I think it was that experience was very helpful and healing. And I don't think it would have happened just by kind of going to the theater. You know, I mean, I think it I owe that to the pandemic.
Singing and dancing and behaving with no abandon and having music be the catalyst for all that, I think it's terrific. And I think a lot of people will be able to relate. There's nothing quite like it. The joy and the sadness, everything in between of being alone and mm-hmm. and being able to experience both the past and the present and maybe the future at the same time via music. It's amazing what it can do.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I taught my daughters all these songs. You know, I mean, I took care, you know, I didn't have a very, in terms of what I was going to pass on from my childhood, I didn't, the people who raised me were dead. And I was determined that she would know the words and music and story and book to Gigi. You know, I mean, something, you know, My Fair Lady, Sound of Music,
Brigadoon.
Carousel. I mean, you know, there was some, yeah, Brigadoon. Mm-hmm. I mean, something, Cinderella, the Rodgers and Hammerstein version. I mean, there were some things that were, you know, not going to die. Yes, music is, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting. But yes, I've been dancing and singing my way out of any depression that comes along.
Well, keep doing it. It's a good self-therapy, self-help, and you don't need to go out and buy a kitschy book either. It's the best kind of
self-help. Or a robot.
Or Sherry Turkle, as we come into a new normal, which is going to be happening the next maybe 3-6 months, certainly a year, a new normal is going to emerge, and it's not going to be exactly how it was before. A lot of things are going to be different, but the overarching theme of a lot of your work has been the relationship between emotions, between humans and technology and computers and all of that melding together. Are we going to be in a better or worse place as we come out of this? Are you pessimistic? Are you optimistic? Do you think is it damaged us irreparably as a society? What do you see? What do you predict?
Well, I think, you know, I studied with Victor Turner, and a great anthropologist at the University of Chicago as part of my graduate education. And he had a concept of liminality, but times betwixt and between, which is what we've had. And take away the fancy word and what a betwixt and between time does for you is that old rules are gone, new rules haven't been born, and you have choices that you didn't see as choices anymore. New combinations can happen. You know, when last time America had something like this was in the 60s, we didn't make radical political changes so much as rules about sexuality changed, rules about how teenagers looked, rules about race relations, who you could bring home to your mother. I mean, we forget how segregated childhood was. We forget, how not just between black and white, but between the siloing of religious groups and where friendships were made. And, I went to a Harvard where, for example, where my friends were the Jewish kids from public high schools who'd gotten scholarships to Harvard. And that wasn't because I was like so shy and didn't want to meet anybody, but I was never invited. I wasn't allowed in the clubs where the other people were. I mean, I wasn't like trying to be special. My point is that things can really change during these times of betwixt and between. And I think to say the thing I'm most positive about is that in the area of technology, I was doing a study before the pandemic where education companies were trying to sell people on, we have a program and it will track your child's learning and it will measure every keystroke. It'll measure when he or she is bored. It'll present content, that's exactly right for him or her. Basically, I don't want to say a cradle to grave, but a cradle to college learning environment. You get the best teachers. We'll have Sherry Turkle on tape for you. Everybody perfect. If you tried to sell that to a parent now, I think the parent would say, could you please give my child a person? My child needs a person to talk to, a mentor. My child does not need a screen. Enough with the screens. And I think that the oversell of your education on a screen, denuding education of the people and putting in the screens, I think that people have had a wake-up call of how much education is really about the people you meet along the way. And so much of the Empathy Diaries is about the power of the people I met along the way. I've had so much time to reflect on the importance of that mentoring. And I think now the pandemic has given everybody that time to say, these screens are great, but we need people. We need people to have the education that children need. And that is one of the places where I am most optimistic. We're going to be much less smitten by those kinds of ideas. And we're going to value more, what I'm calling the full embrace of the human.
The full embrace of the human. I hope we get there. I hope we aren't at dinner and 15 minutes in say, I have to take this call. I have to glance at my phone, but don't worry. It's just 10 seconds, a quick glance.
It's just 10 seconds.
Then I'll put it down. And then the other person, either, as you've talked about, either sort of looks around and feels the secondary or as a sort of defense mechanism, they pick up their phone too. And then the people are just both staring at their phones, which I guess is better than one, right?
This scene is so dystopian and so widespread. I mean, it's where we are. But I'm trying to say now I think we've had an experience where maybe we won't do that so quickly anymore. We've had a lot of screen time. We've had a lot of screen time.
And now we need the person.
And now we know we need the person. It's not just we need the person, it's we know we need the person.
Sherry Turkle, the new book, The Empathy Diaries, and many wonderful things in here to look at and discuss. And I do appreciate this conversation. It's just been a real pleasure.
Well, for me too.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.